right. Hey, I'm live here in STS Studios, and I got my partner in crime, Mean Gene. I had to call you Mean Gene. Mean Gene Jackson here. Gene, welcome. And we're going to do our new show for everyone.
I'm excited about this one, Brian. I love the concept, and I spend a lot of time watching old wrestling shows anyway, so if I feel like I'm doing something moderately constructive with it, then that's a plus.
Well, you know, I had a couple of people, I come up with ideas all the time. I just type them up, put them to the side. You and me have had a couple of shows, and used to do shows together, had a real good chemistry, and I was like, man, I've got to pick one of these and try to get Gene to do it, and didn't want to give you, you know, one every other week like I do Lance. But this is something that me and you, I like the new style of wrestling. I really like a lot of the new stuff. But I also still like the old stuff. But we have those guys that will not watch anything. But this old, the old wrestling, you know, it has to be 1942 yeah. or at least the 70s or the 80s before they would even watch it. And so I thought it would be fun. We take a show from the vault. So if you got the WWE Network, you can go watch Mid-South Wrestling 6-12-82. That's June the 12th, 1982. Watch it. Just stop this podcast. Go watch it and come back. And me and Gene, we're going to answer the question, was it really that good? So, hey, Gene, let's get started. Mid-South Wrestling, June the 12th, 1982. What was your first impression when it first came out?
Well, you know, just as a bit of context for people quickly, I was born in 1977, and my regular wrestling fandom, where I started watching it all the time and following it, starts up around 86. But I'm familiar with pretty much everybody on this show. So, you know, right out of the gate, I know it's dubbed over for the network, but they got that sweet theme music, you know, that sounds it's on a Casio keyboard or something.
Yeah, right before we came on, I actually played that sweet theme music. So I want you to know that. You got to own it for that. So.
Nice. So as we come in, you know, we got Cowboy Bill Watts, and we're building towards the Superdome show coming up on July 17th. And I guess before I jump ahead of the first match, let's see what your takeaway is there at the beginning.
Well, you know, there's something about Watts during the whole show, and it really comes across in the opening. Boyd Pierce is all dressed up, and Bill's not. And I always thought that was really funny. Boyd seemed like he looked like an announcer, like Lance Russell and Dave Brown kind of thing. I always remember that. Bill, throughout the show, and I've got some things wrote down that he says. But, man, if we had announcers that actually explained everything the way he did, he would get to the point to where I was tired of listening to it, but he was making sure we knew when the show was, we knew who the champions were. We knew everything about that show just by watching one show. But yeah, that's the big thing when it first opens, is that you see such a contrast in two people right there.
Yeah, that's true, but Boyd Pierce is always pretty snazzily dressed in every episode. It's a sight to behold.
And then we have the first matchup. We have Randy Bass, and I'll ask you, if you know any of these people, when we start talking about these jobbers, I don't remember a Randy Bass. A match with Mike Sharp. Now, I remember Iron Mike Sharp in WWE, and he had a real fun run in Memphis that I really liked. But, God, this was a bad match.
Well, I was about to say, an 80s television show opening with a job match featuring Iron Mike Sharp does not sound unusual until you realize Iron Mike Sharp's not the jobber. He's the guy who's being featured here, which is, to me, highly unusual. I mean, I mostly remember him from his long stint jobbing for the WWF with his, you know, the leather forearm pad for the never-ending injury. But like you said, I have learned, and because like I said, most of my fandom starts around 86. But going back and watching a ton of old Memphis on YouTube and through all my tape trading throughout the years, I did come to learn that Iron Mike Sharp did have runs in Mid-South and Memphis and whatnot where he wasn't a jobber. And I was quite shocked and surprised at that. But
well, he was a good.
Yeah, his match with Randy Bass did not, you know, would not garner very many stars in anybody's ratings list for sure.
Well, he was, you know, what they always said, a good hand. I think that's what you would call a guy like that. And it's funny that I thought he did one of the worst drop kicks. And then he did it twice. That's what was so funny. It's like, no, we're not going to cut that out. We're going to do it again. It was just – and then he won. What move was that? He put him in like a – I don't know. He had his,
an over-the-shoulder it was some kind of weird backbreaker.
It was a
backbreaker randomly.
Yeah, it was
real
weird.
Another thing caught my eye about this whole thing too. Those ropes were so freaking loose. Like, they were ridiculous. Like, just dangling down. Like, that was the first thing I noticed when the match started. Like, God, those ropes are loose. And I got thinking, like, well, you know, nobody's going to be doing any 450s or anything like that. So I guess that's okay. But yeah, some kind of odd backbreaker. Put Randy Bass away in a, you know.
It's hard to explain, but he was actually holding Randy by his hands with him, Randy on his back. I don't know. It's just hard to explain. And just did not look didn't look good at all. I thought it was funny, too. Watts actually called Ted DiBiase. I don't know if you caught this. Called him Ted DiBiase during part of that.
Yes. In those old shows, when you go back and watch them, he would call Ted DiBiase Ted DiBiase, and he always called Hacksaw Jim Duggan. And even though he would say right in front of him, Hacksaw Jim Duggan, he'd go, oh, that's right, Jim Duggan. Like, he was just adamant about calling him Duggan instead of Duggan.
And they were really pushing the hell out of Mr. Olympia and JYD during the commentary. Apparently, one of them... both of them had single belts, but didn't have the North America title, but they both had single belts at the time and were the tag team champs. So Bill had to explain to us that if one of them won the North America title, that they would have to vacate the tag belts. But right now they don't have
to. Yeah, he drove that home.
Yeah, very a couple of times. So,
yes.
And then we had an interview with Ted DiBiase, or what the hell you want to call him, Ted DiBiase, doing a babyface interview, but kind of being an asshole. He was against the promotion because they haven't given him a match that he deserved.
Yeah. Yeah, I thought the psychology behind that whole promo was interesting. Like you said, he's clean-shaven, babyface. Ted DiBiase, but then, like I said, he's kind of being a jerk and kind of being somewhat of a crybaby. Like, well, I don't get my way. In 2 weeks, I'm just going to leave. You know, like, what kind of babyface is that? Like,
if he don't get a title shot, and if he does get the title shot and he loses, he's still going to leave. And I was like,
that's right. So.
What the hell?
Yeah, then, you know, Bill Watts is supposed to be the king of psychology, but that was some very, very strange psychology, in my opinion.
Me too. And then we had Ted DiBiase in a squash. Something I really noticed is there's just way lots of squashes in a, 48 minutes or 42 minutes? You have so many matches. That's without the commercials. So DiBiase gets in a ring with Mike Bond. I still have no idea who that was either. Ted was just always, and you know this, and every, just such a great wrestler, a great worker, and always looked really good in the ring, no matter how young he was.
Oh, yeah. The thing that stood out to me at the opening of this one was that Mike Bond actually had a flashier jacket than Ted DiBiase did, which was ironic knowing what DiBiase would go on to be eventually. Maybe that's what drove him.
That green
but
jacket.
But we saw a multitude of hip tosses. Like, it was hip toss mania. But, I mean, it really reminded me, though, what a great, you know, technical wrestler DiBiase was as a babyface. You know, he really was, you know, I mean, over time, once he went to WWF and came to Million Dollar Man, you know, he kind of became a series of you know, moves, kind of like a lot of guys. But, man, he was really, really talented as a babyface back then. But, man, he was all over them hip tosses.
Yeah, I thought also, too, but just watching him, what he'd done in the ring, he was just so smooth. And I can't remember actually seeing him green. You know, you remember some of these guys growing up, oh, they were green in that match, and I don't ever really remember seeing him green at all. And then he won with that quick power slam. The match didn't last long at all.
No, but it certainly didn't need to. So he got his points crossed. He slapped the power slam on. Like you said, though, man, and the more you watch a lot of these old 80s, you know, TV shows like that, it was all about the squash matches, man. It was just one after another, as quick as they could rapid fire them out there.
Yeah, and it, you know, I remember that in Memphis, but I just didn't remember it so much in Mid-South because I guess I started watching a little bit later in Mid-South, more like when Dundee took over as Booker. So it was almost like this stuff was stuff that I had read about, but I don't know if I remember seeing any of this stuff. You know, JYD being as popular as it was at this time. And I don't ever remember, you know, Root being a North American champion. And this was after, I remember reading Grappler's book, Grappler's on here later, but this is after the Grappler actually was the North American champion and ran with it for, you know, about 8 months. So our champion, Bob Roop, is the North American champ. Did he do an interview before or after this match?
Before, and oh my God, it was so shitty. Like, it was a terrible promo. Although he did deliver the great line, I would beat my own mother for the North American title or something to that effect. And God, if that North American title belt wasn't the ugliest damn belt I've ever seen. I mean, I was like, wow, guys are really fighting for this thing? Like, that thing is horrid.
Oh, it was. It was just, It looked like someone had made it. Like, you know, some of these independent belts that we see, you know, that they bring to the shows,
yeah.
And you're thinking they're defending the Mid-Southern CWA whatever belt. I was like, this is the North American belt, which had, you know, I thought had some prestige to it. And after you see that, you're thinking to yourself, that was a total piece of shit. So, hey, man, what about
I feel like...
Go ahead.
Okay, go ahead. I was going to say, I feel like maybe 3 or 4 years prior, Bill walked in the dressing room one night and was like, hey, look what Joel made in shop class this week. It's a North American title belt. Tell him it looks nice. I know it sucks, but, you know, he's trying.
Oh, my God. Yeah, that sounds like it. You know, he made it. It's awesome. Yeah. Oh, my God. You know, he pushed Joel Watts down her face, you know, down her throats, too. So down her face, too. So I don't know where I got that. Here we go. We're going to take our commercial break. We'll be right back, and we'll finish up with this episode. All right, we're back with my old buddy Gene Jackson, and we're covering Mid-South Wrestling in June of 1982. We got the Bob Roop squash coming up. Now, this guy's name was Mike Hutspin or something like that.
Yeah, you think for a ring name, he could have just made up something a little easier to pronounce than that. And to touch on something real quick from back before the break, I just want to throw it out there. I think it was Eric Watts that he pushed down our face back in 92, not Joel.
Maybe it was neither here nor there. But Joel was always the announcer, and he was always in front of the camera also. We got to see.
This
squash match was horrible, too. Bob Roop, now, tell me if I'm wrong here, because, you know, I sometimes forget shit, and I didn't look this up. But Bob Roop, wasn't he supposed to be a shooter and a tough guy and all this?
He had a great amateur background that, you know, Bill Watts got hard for, and... You know, all that, and you know, he was a tough guy, and he was a shooter, and he got in fights outside of in the bars, and you know, things of that nature. But what I've seen of him going back and watching, I was never that impressed with him. The thing that really stands out for me is remembering him with Kevin Sullivan in Florida a few years later, with half his hair shaved off and his face painted, and you know, he was in Kevin's devil, you know, gimmick down there. I, when I think of Bob Roop, that's what I think of more so than this version of Bob Roop here with his Kurt Angle singlet on and such.
And that was a horrible... And I actually looked away, came back, saw the replay of the finish. You know, I was so lazy I couldn't push rewind. But he won with the leg drop, right?
He did, brother. But, you know, one thing I noticed listening to this, and I guess it stood out to me because I just recently read JR's book, which is a really good read, by the way. But, man, you really can tell watching these old shows how much Bill Watts influenced Jim Ross as an announcer and a commentator. I mean, there's a whole, you hear a whole lot of what would later become JR and Bill Watts back then.
You do.
As far as putting over the legit athletics and just the way he described everything, like you talked about earlier, you know, he does really good at like covering like some of the botches and stuff like that. But man, I never realized just how much until watching this, how much he influenced Jim Ross.
Well, I 100% agree with you that. I noticed that, too. It was like some of the comments he made, I was like, wait, is that Jim Ross? And, I mean, I really can't. I know it
exactly.
Was. It, you know, Watts was his biggest influence in the world, and you can really see it by just listening to him. Watts also cracked me up all the time of talking about everyone was upset. Always somebody upset. Upset about something. And I just cracked up about that, you know. They showed clips of JYD against Rude. And, man, JYD was in such great shape.
Holy shit. That, if there's one takeaway of this entire show that stands out to me more than anything, is the phenomenal shape that JYD was in back in 82. Like, holy cow. Like, even in what's considered his prime and his heyday, a few years later in WWF, he was nowhere close to the shape he was in here. Like, man, he could have been on top in WWF if he'd have came there in the shape he was here in 82.
Oh, I agree. Just excellent shape. They did an angle where the one-man gang jumped in outside the ring, and Ernie Ladd made the save. I thought it was – I love the angle that they did where DiBiase jumps in and keeps JYD from getting hurt. And I don't remember how that goes. I really think in the back of my mind DiBiase is going to turn eventually against him anyway. I don't know. I can't remember how all that goes. But I actually like that. DiBiase actually takes the knee to the head from Roop, I believe.
He did, and I was like, man, he must have shoot loved JYD in real life, because I'll be dang if that big bastard, as gangly as he was in that match, would have jumped off with a knee in the back of my freaking head. Like, that just ain't happening. Bless his heart, that had to be rough. But and there was a couple, there was like a botched backdrop in there, and the thing that really stood out to me also is One Man Gang, man. This is back when he still had that Crusher Broomfield look that he, you know, came in from you know, the Poffos promotion with, and man, like, he looked completely different with the long hair and all that. And then of course, you know, you got the Assassin and the Grappler coming in as well, which we'll see later in the show.
Yeah. Oh, well, JYD did a squash then, and he used to come out to Another One Bites the Dust, right?
Yes. Yes, we got the network dub there, which is so generic. You see those people in the crowd going crazy, like, oh, wow, can you imagine if this was really the music that had been playing at the time? I don't think his reaction would have been quite the same.
No, and I was like, and he just wasn't that good in the ring. I remember a story that Meltzer had actually told me on the phone, because Meltzer was big buddies with Terry Funk. And Funk was wrestling JYD, and he told JYD just to stand in the middle of the ring. And he would work the whole match. And it's one of those, he worked the whole match. And if you watch it, it's Funk's doing the whole thing, and JYD's just standing there. And I, you know, JYD wasn't good, but, man, he had the charisma and everything, and I could understand why he was over. The next match, which I cracked up at the guy doing the ring announcing, he told us this was going to be a match between two very big men.
It's as literal as you get right there.
A one-man gang against Ernie Ladd, who, oh, God, one-man gang was like 10 times the wrestler Ernie Ladd was. I don't know how Ladd got over so big, but he was really over.
Everything, and you're right, because, like, gang, this is in his very, very, very early stages. But, man, that's the thing that really stood out to me. Because, really, Ladd, like, I only knew him from wrestling magazines. And, you know, I haven't really seen a lot of footage of him. But everything he did looked so damn hokey and just phony as shit. And I was like, good Lord, this is terrible, until Gang took over. The only thing he did that was impressive was once Killer Khan hit the ring, the bump over the top rope from the kick looked pretty good. But, man, other than that, I was like, oh, my God, this is some of the phoniest looking shit. I'm surprised Bill Watts isn't having a come apart over there. But I guess most of his matches looked like that at that point in his career.
Well, was it just because he was, you know, such a huge, big football player that, you know, Watts had the hard on for him?
I think so. I think because, you know, he didn't really do it. Like, you didn't realize until he got in the ring. Like, I had watched another episode before this, and it was, I mean, it was the one from later on, but he's sitting at the table with, you know, Boyd Pierce, and just sitting there, you know, he just looks like a dude, you know, but you don't realize how freakishly tall he is until he gets in there with, like, one-man gang and stuff. And you're like, wow, that dude is really freaking tall. And, I, you know, I guess that was the deal, you know, like, oh, he's a huge football player. And, you know, I guess he was, you know, he was on, like, he wasn't just like some college guy. Like, he was in the NFL and was pretty well known. So I guess, you know, the fact Watts was able to play off his, you know, name and reputation and the size of him. But, man, once the bell rang, as they say, it was pretty tough to watch.
I thought it was, too. I thought Killer Khan, you know, I always liked him in World Class. But, all right, so we're up next with Rick Hangman Harris against Tony Torres. And we know Rick Hangman Harris as Black Bart.
Absolutely. When he come out there, it took me a minute. Like, oh, yeah, I forgot. He was Hangman Harris before he was Black Bart. So that's right, although he looks no different and wrestles no different. It was just simply a name change.
Did you notice that he used the same finisher to Sharp, I think?
Okay, so I'm not crazy because when I said that about him using the weird backbreaker, I thought, well, no, that had to be Hangman Harris. But then I thought, no, I wrote backbreaker next to Sharp. And so I'm glad you just pointed that out because I thought I had lost my mind. Yes, they both used the world's most awkward backbreaker as their finish. And, I mean, and how did that get by them back then? I mean, you know, used to, they say that you didn't want people wearing the same color trunks, and they went out of their way to make sure people didn't, you know, replicate what somebody had already done in the show. And you got that weird finish being used twice on the same TV. That's just completely odd to me.
And then we had, I guess you call it the main event. It was pretty much, you know, probably the best match on the show, very much so. Some really good guys, workers in there. King Cobra teaming with Jesse Barr. And Jesse, I guess, was came in from Portland at the time. The Grappler had come, was tagging with the Assassin. The best I can tell, that was Jody Hamilton, the very original Assassin. Grappler, the best worker of the four, very much so, just bumping all over the place. But no, here's what I really notice about the old stuff. There's just no psychology whatsoever, none whatsoever.
And that's mind-blowing because that's what all the old-school fans and the old-school wrestlers bitch about incessantly. There's no psychology, this new crowd, there's no psychology. Go back and watch some of this stuff. I love the Grappler, one of my favorite mass wrestlers of all time. If you haven't read his book, people listen to this, I highly recommend it. Lynn Denton, really great wrestling book. And then you get to see King Cobra, who I didn't see him until he looked to be 70 years old after he won the unified title from Jerry Lawler. So you got the future unified champion and the future Jimmy Jack Funk teaming up here. But just the minute I laid eyes on him, all I could do is hear, King Cobra! He's going to be taken out. Like, I just automatically heard Corey Macklin's voice in my head the minute I saw King Cobra. And I'm like, wow, like, there was a time King Cobra wasn't old as hell. That's pretty awesome. I didn't realize it.
Yeah, it is fantastic shape, too. I mean, he never got out of shape, really, but never a solid worker. He knew what he was doing. But Barr was, you know, a little bit better than the average worker. Not at this point, but he eventually become, you know, just imitating the Funks pretty much, but was a decent worker. But Grappler, to me, Assassin was okay. He knew what to do, when to do it, was good about getting, you know, and doing the bumps on a hot tag and stuff like that. But like I said, absolutely no psychology. I'm just sitting there going, what the fuck? And then we get, you talk about Ernie Ladd, okay? So Ernie Ladd comes out here, and guys, I'm not trying to be racist here. I wish I didn't have to say I wasn't trying to be racist, but he reminds me of this classic 70s black movie star. It's what, when he's doing it, you know, like he's getting ready to fight in, against ninjas or something. You know, I just, that's all I could think about is he probably belonged in one of the 70s black, you know, black films there.
Oh God, yes, he was tailor made for those blaxploitation films of the '70s back then. He would have been perfect with Mean Joe Green and all those guys that made those freaking movies back then.
I used to get those movies. They were like, when I was in college, Hastings had like five movies for $5 for 5 days. And I would get those movies, the ninja movies, you know, just Godzilla movies, the worst movies in the world. And all I could think about when I heard him start talking and talking to Watson was that he would have been perfect in that role. Okay, man, I got to ask you before I do my little catchphrase and we get out of here. I got to ask you, Gene, was it really that good?
Man, I know we've shit on a lot of it. I mean, there's at least three different matches where we go, that was horrible. But ultimately, and maybe it's skewed because of what we have coming up in the future, but it wasn't that bad. I don't know if I'll say this particular episode was that good. I do love what I've watched of a lot of the old Mid-South. I can't defend this episode as being that good, but it wasn't that bad either. It was watchable.
All right. Well, you know, I kind of feel like you do. If I wanted to recommend you guys to – that's why I told them to watch it before, because I don't know if I can recommend you to watch it. If you want to watch it, the things to look out for is just, you know, like we said, Ted DiBiase, JYD, Jack to the gills, looking great shape. And Bill Watts was just tremendous on the microphone. I don't, you know, if everyone talks about psychology in old school when it comes to wrestling, you know, this wasn't that good. But just overall, it was old Mid-South wrestling and actually what wrestling was back in the 80s. So, hey, guys, remember – same bad time, same bad channel on the best little wrestling podcast in the business. Love my mama. And be there!